So you can, a way to see this and how it's related to this hierarchy problem in the standard model is just think about these diagrams in the standard model. Okay, so just in the standard model, we could always do this calculation where we have the internal Higgs field itself. We could have the W or the Z in these internal diagrams. Or we can do the fermion loop, similar to the way we were just talking about the fermion loop. And that exists. These diagrams exist. And you could do these integrals in the standard model alone, just using dimensional regularization, or you could put a hard cutoff scale, right? So the contribution, there's still a contribution to H dagger H. You find in doing these diagrams, you do the two-point function, and you look at the term that is not proportional to P squared, because the P squared term that you get in here has to do with dH. It's the kinetic term, right? dH. So you look at the term in that diagram when you expand it out that isn't proportional to P squared, and you get a shift. And the shift that you get for the Higgs mass, just in the standard model alone, it goes as 3 over 16 pi squared, and then you get contributions from all the masses of the internal states. The Higgs mass, the Z mass, the W mass, and then all the fermions. So it's summed over all the fermions. Of course, the biggest one is the top quark, which is a large mass scale. So this is something known as a Veltman condition, if you were to think about this actually canceling. So what do I mean by that? So what Veltman actually did, ironically, Veltman's student was Tuft, who developed dimensional regularization, and Veltman's on those papers as well. But this calculation has to do with the hard cutoff scale, the way it's usually presented in the literature. So what he did was he observed this calculation leads to these shifts to the Higgs mass. And at that time, in the late 70s, the Higgs mass, of course, was not discovered at all. It was just speculation far in the future. The top quark was not understood. It was not known to be as massive as it was. And these mass scales were just roughly indicated. But nevertheless, you could start to think about this sort of thing and think that once we actually find the Z mass, the W mass, and all of the masses of the fermions are firmed up, this sort of calculation tells you that if the Higgs mass took on a particular value, you could imagine this canceling. So sometimes in the literature, you'll see discussions about the Veltman condition and quadratic divergences. And what they mean by that is what he actually did was he actually did this calculation with a hard cutoff scale with a lambda, not in Dirac. So you get this multiplied by lambda squared over v squared, just to make up the mass dimensions. This is what actually you get in this regulator. And this is like the epsilon that you get in Dirac. It's from the divergence. This combination you get in both cases, this combination appears in the finite shifts that you get. In this case, the particles are the standard model particles. And then there's an epsilon. And what is being in the initial Veltman paper is being written down in terms of this hard cutoff scale. Okay, but you still get this combination of masses given here. So this 3, you might wonder about this 3 and about color. This 3 is coming about in two different ways. It's coming about that there's these two diagrams, and when they add up together, you get that 3 in the case of the bosons. And you get the 3 for just the sum over colors directly when you have the fermions. So this, in one case, it's an NC. In the other case, it's the diagram combinatorics. That's just around. So anyways, before we found any scalar, which we did in 2012, indicating its mass to be 125 GeV, we could have imagined, and Veltman did imagine, that, well, maybe the scalar mass that we'll find will be such that these sorts of contributions can cancel. So that actually selects for about 314 GeV, and then it would lead to, at one loop, these contributions being vanishing, or at least highly suppressed. Now, of course, that's not the mass scale of the scalar that we found. It's actually 125 GeV. But nevertheless, in the literature, you'll see discussions about things about the Veltman condition and about that being something that you would imagine being satisfied to reduce the sensitivity of quadratic divergences. So I'm just laying this out to you to kind of like dispel some confusion, because there is something here that's a bit odd, which is that there's a regulator dependence, right? And so if we choose a different regulator, what is the meaning of this condition and this value of the Higgs mass? The thing that is independent of how you regulate, whether you choose a hard cutoff scale or you choose dim reg, is that you get this combination. In the one case, it's just sitting here as a finite contribution that you subtract the epsilon pole directly. In the other case, the hard cutoff scale lambda that you're getting with these sum over masses v divided by v squared, that the hard cutoff scale still gives you the same combination of masses, right? So you get the same combination. You might remember in the neutrino example that we looked at, there was an epsilon pole that you were subtracting that had a shift due to the heavy mass scale, and then finite terms as well that would not be subtracted, which were just left over even when you subtracted the epsilon pole. So in both cases, so long as you're associating this cutoff scale with heavy mass scale particles, say, for example, like the neutrino mass, then you get the same physical conclusion in terms of the UV sensitivity due to the heavy mass scale. But this alone is something that's just a regulator choice, which you can choose different regulators, and so you shouldn't overinterpret the dependence that you get just associated with lambda. So this leads to some confusion at times in the literature, because sometimes people look at this sort of condition and then they want to basically impose this sort of condition on physics beyond the standard model. And it historically was something that people thought a lot about in terms of building new physics sectors and then having this sort of thing cancel out if you have a bunch of different particles. Okay. So that's what I was just saying, that in dimensional regularization, you just subtract the epsilon pole, and you still get a shift, which is a finite shift, to the Higgs mass after that epsilon. So the regulator-independent conclusion is associated with the physical mass shift due to physical particles in the spectrum. And in this case, the physical particles are the standard model particles. Okay, so that's always true, and that's regulator-independent. And so long as you think of this cutoff scale as a proxy for some actual mass scale, you will not be led astray by regulator dependence. You have to be careful about that, because the one thing you know about an arbitrary regulator you put in by hand in the theory is that, you know, it's an artifact. It's something you've chosen, which, you know, will cancel when you actually relate different observables with the same regulator. So there's a mathematical arbitrariness of the cutoff, the scale that we put in. But so long as that cutoff scale is correctly in the dimensional analysis way, standing in for a heavy mass scale that you remove from the theory, then you get something that's regulator independent. It's a physical conclusion because it's based on physical masses leading to this shift. This is a very subtle point, and I'm belaboring it because it is something that causes a lot of confusion, because there's just a lot of papers written for decades where people were looking at different regulators and arguing with one another, and there's a lot of confusion, frankly, historically related to this point. And dimensional regularization versus a hard cutoff scale. So I hope I didn't further confuse you. Is the point been made clearly? Like, did you get what I'm saying here in terms of what's physical? Regulator independent is what depends on the actual mass scales. Okay. And in the case of the neutrino, the heavy neutrino, the physical extra thing was the heavy neutrino mass, which is why it really does lead to a shift in the Higgs mass, which is something that you're worried about in terms of canceling off different contributions to get to an observed value of the Higgs mass, which is so small. And that's quite generic. Okay, so one further thing related to this historically, I'm not going to get into this because the particle physics class, they're going to get into this in a lot of the class that follows in a lot of detail, but like you can hopefully see a very straightforward fact that is a basic fact that's coming from just the statistics of the particles that are running inside the loop, which could argue for making choices to make it so that you, when you have heavy mass scales and you think about how they affect the Higgs mass, you can have cancellations like this, like from the Veltman condition. So what is that observation? It's just this sign, right? So when you have spin statistics, when you have Fermi statistics, when you have internal loops like this, remember, just because when you sum over spins, you get an extra minus sign. Whereas when you have bosons, you don't get that extra minus sign. It's just a relative sign that happens. So part of the idea of thinking about cancellations to the Higgs mass, because people worry about this UV sensitivity of the Higgs mass due to heavy states, it also falls into thinking about, well, this relative sign is something that you might want to exploit. If you're going to add stuff in the UV, this is all standard model mass scales, right? So these contributions, loop contributions at the Higgs mass, are small corrections to the Higgs mass that we observe, and you don't need to cancel this. But if you're having very heavy mass scales, like the neutrino just sitting there alone that we talked about, that does lead to a large shift in the Higgs mass. So you might think that, well, the solution is in the direction of, let's add a bunch of particles above the standard model, integrate a bunch of things out, and have this relationship between the mass scales of the particles we integrate out, and have both bosons and fermions, and cancel these contributions. Right? That's like a reasonable direction to go. And that lives off the fact that there's a relative sign, which is a very basic thing that will happen due to spin statistics alone. Okay? You don't have to do a lot of engineering for that to happen. So this generic cancellation between bosons and fermions is something that you might want to exploit. And so if you think about it, what you need to cancel off contributions to the Higgs mass using that would be, you want to have the same number of fermions as bosons. You want to have the same couplings of the bosons and the fermions to the Higgs. And then you just want to have the relative sign lead to cancellations. So you can so if you want to have the same mass scale for the bosons and the fermions, you want to have the same coupling for the bosons and the fermions to the Higgs, and then you just want this relative sign to give these cancellations, then the obvious thing to do is to put the bosons and fermions in a multiplet. That multiplet gets a common mass, and it has some common gauge coupling to that multiplet, right? So that's the way to engineer that this will just happen. So that basic idea of just having the number of bosons, the mass scale of the bosons and the fermions being the same, means probably put them in a multiplet under a symmetry representation, and have the same number of degrees of freedom. So that gets a bit weird in the sense of, you know, you have to worry about the color degrees of freedom as well, the three colors, that you'd have to relate that to the bosons. But you can do that. And you want the same couplings. When you do that and you engineer that in a beautiful way, that's what leads you to in the direction of supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is exactly a symmetry which is doing this. Okay? So I'm not going to get into that. The follow-up class will get into that in detail. But that's, you can kind of see, is something that is kind of motivated out of the basic fact that there's a relative sign and the fact that the Higgs mass is UV sensitive. Now, there's challenges in supersymmetry because if you just added multiplets in the UV which had this cancellation, then, you know, that's one thing. But in the case of thinking about supersymmetry, it's a symmetry that also applies to the standard model states. So every one of these particles has a super partner. And so those, you know, we basically see half of all the particles that you would think. Just in the case of the standard model, you should have the standard model particles, you should have all the super partners for that. And then possibly if you're adding new field content with unbroken super multiplets, you can add that in the UV. But you need to have all the partner states of the standard model. And because we know the mass scales of the standard model states, we don't expect the partner supersymmetric particles to be much heavier than what we see. So there can be some splitting. Supersymmetry doesn't have to be an exact symmetry. It can be broken. But you don't want it to be broken too much. So that's also why we're looking very hard around TV mass scales to see if we find any super partners related to the standard model states. Okay? Is this clear? It's kind of just living off a minus sign, but it's a very important minus sign, yeah.
Where does the factor 4 for the fermion mass come from?
That's just when you just do the Yukawa couplings because it's related to the mass.
Oh.
So there's a 3, which is this NC, but it's just summing up and taking it to the mass, and like there's a square root of 2, remember, in the Yukawa. If you just work it out, it's that factor.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of a really basic thing, but of course this leads to very complex and very complete model building on, based on that idea. Okay, but the key issue is the sensitivity in the Higgs mass is there due to heavy physics states in the UV, and it's just dimensional analysis at the end of the day. Okay, so that's really the issue. Fighting dimensional analysis in physics is like a battle you're kind of guaranteed to lose. So don't fight that battle. Okay. All right. Well, let me just make sure. Is there any other? I mean, I'm not going to get into this. The follow-up class will talk about like this a lot. But I just wanted to give you the basic idea because we talked about, you know, contributions to the Higgs mass. Are there any questions related to this before I move on? So I'm going to switch gears into other things now. Is this all? This should be very. It's very simple, but you know, it gets very complicated. But at this stage, it should be very simple. Is that all good? All right, another thing, so there's two other things I want to get through and talk about. One's pretty quick, and the other is going to take a little bit longer. So we're thinking a lot about symmetries, and we talked about lepton and baryon number and the way that they appeared in the operators and in the simple case of neutrino masses, okay? And then having the seesaw model give neutrino masses. So you probably noticed that there was a non-trivial nature of how these global lepton and baryon number violating effects were coming about, right? Remember in the standard model, the thing that was strange, well, it's just accidental, is that at tree level, we look at the Lagrangian, we do these rephasings of the, so we have, and with leptons, we do these rephasings with all the leptons. We do these rephasings, and we have this accidental global lepton number conservation. The phase transformation cancels. And for baryon number, we have an accidental global symmetry as well, just in the standard model Lagrangian, just doing those rephasings. So that's just a global symmetry. It's not gauged, but it is accidentally preserved in the standard model. And that was the case. And what are the mass dimensions of the operators in the standard model? That's the case in the standard model where you have dimension, mass dimension operators of 2 and 4, which are even. Then we looked at this. The first thing we could add when we went beyond dimension 4 was of this form, just by hypercharge. And you should step back and think of, well, why are these lepton and baryon number operators, then this, why is this behavior happening in dimension 2 and dimension 4? Of course, the operator forms we're allowed to write down are limited by conserved hypercharge, as well as the other global symmetries. Hypercharge, though, is really playing the key role. So this is linked to the fact that hypercharge is not violated up to dimension 2 and dimension 4 operators. This operator form doesn't violate hypercharge either, but because we've gone to dimension 5, while not violating hypercharge, we're allowed to write down these terms. And this does violate lepton number, this charge conjugate. So the charge conjugate and then a dagger means that this basically carries the same lepton number as L. So this is lepton number 2, right? This violates lepton number, which is something you needed to do to actually get neutrino masses. That violation of lepton number actually is associated with neutrino mass. But it's non-trivial that at D equals 5, we suddenly were violating lepton number. And then we looked at, very briefly, some operators, and I think that you'll also look at them more today. Is it today that they're gonna look at more? Next Tuesday? Okay, you'll look at this more in the future. How you can have operators that violate baryon number, which lead to proton decay. And when we wrote those down, that was at D equals 6, right? So it's a very reasonable question to ask and observation to make, that it seems like the global symmetry structure of lepton and baryon number is not independent of the mass dimension of the operators themselves. And that is the case. And so what is the general observation, the general structure of how the global symmetry violating operators come in? Well, there's actually a theorem that you can prove and was proven in this paper here. This was, believe it or not, this was in 2016, someone finally proved this. So it gives you an idea that people are still figuring stuff out. I remember that this paper came out. I know the guy. So just using hypercharge, essentially, you can define a shift in baryon number for an operator and a shift in lepton number for an operator. So what do you do here? Well, you add up the number of Q fields and the number of daggered up fields and down fields, and then the opposite you subtract. You have to, this 3 is because you're summing over colors, so it actually cancels when you actually, so this you know, is for one color field, so when you do the sum, you'll cancel the 3, usually with the operator, because it'll have, you know, the color index. The same thing you can define for a lepton number shift in an operator. So it's just this sum, oops, yep, with these daggers on the charge lepton and the neutrino. So that difference is like the lepton number violation of an operator. The difference here is the baryon number violation of an operator. And it's provable and proven from hypercharge. You can look in the paper for like the basic hypercharge derived constraint condition and how the steps go, that the shift in baryon number minus the shift in lepton number divided by 2 is going to be an integer that also follows from hypercharge. And if that integer is even, then you will have a mass dimension even operator. And if that integer is odd, you will get a mass dimension odd operator. Okay? So this is, and this all really, it's hypercharge, conservation, plus Lorentz invariance. So it's a nice exercise to go through. You can go through and refollow the paper. It's really quite straightforward. I don't think it's worth the time of going through in detail on the blackboard, but this observation is the case. This is a general observation that applies to the standard model operators, the dimension 5 operators, and also dimension 6, dimension 7, dimension 8. People are doing a lot of work now on like high mass dimension operators. So just thinking about the Weinberg operator, this one here, does it work? Yes, it does. Delta L is equal to 2. So this is actually 2. Divide by 2. No baryon number violation, so you get D odd, 1. And then that, of course, corresponds to dimension 5. And then the case of the standard model, you actually find that the baryon minus the lepton number is 0. There's even mass dimension operators, and also true for dimension 6, dimension 8. So odd mass dimension operators are going to violate either baryon number or lepton number. And even mass dimension operators are going to have this conserved. They can violate separately baryon number or lepton number, but the difference will be conserved. Okay? So this is just literally hypercharge and Lorentz invariance. So there's a hidden structure in terms of global symmetries in this whole series of the standard model plus this tower of higher dimensional operators. And it also gives you some understanding of the standard model structure itself, like why this accident is happening for baryon and lepton number is that, you know, we're talking about dimension 2 and dimension 4 operators, even mass dimension operators. Okay, so I'm telling you that in part because of what I'm then now going to go on to discuss in more detail in the time we have left today. Oop. This one. Okay, so flaws in the standard model. So one was the standard model directly predicts neutrinos don't have mass. And experimentally, that's not the case. So we talked about going and following that and seeing what can we actually do in terms of following that. So we made a lot of noise and excitement about the fact that the standard model is so generic. We're just writing down what's allowed up to dimension 4 with the assumed symmetries and field content. And then we're just fixing what's there from experiment. And, you know, it just works. And when it doesn't work for neutrino mass, we add the simplest, stupidest thing, and it starts to work again. So it seems very robust. However, and this is a long however digression we're going to have to go into, what about these? No one challenged me. No one was upset about that. But what about these, right? Because for a generic field strength, you can define this. F alpha beta. We even talked about some of this. It came up at times in various discussions. I don't think we talked about this dual field at some point. Maybe we didn't actually. We're going to talk about it now. What's wrong with this? Any ideas? Anyone would give me a declared reason why this is just, I mean, this dimension four? Yeah.
Because the parity is weird because there is like an epsilon or something.
Yeah, but I mean, we have symmetry violating effects in this standard model, right? So actually CP is violated. That's true. But we have CP violating effects. So if these coefficients are non-zero, so also these could have general coefficients, right? But if they're non-zero, yes, CP will be violated. But that's not a good enough reason to dismiss them because we have CP violation. So why, what about that? Why don't we think about these? Yeah. Well, we're going to think about them now, and there's actually like really cool physics here, but yeah.
I think they don't contribute to the equations of motion or something, right? Like.
So they're surface terms. Yeah. They're surface terms. So yes, we're going to get into that point too. But that lets you get rid of some of them, but not all of them. Yeah. So you're thinking in the right directions. Those two things are key to this, but it doesn't allow you to say that we just don't think about all of these. And actually, those two thoughts, which we'll push forward, and baryon and lepton number, believe it or not, are going to make it so that we can start to think about why to get rid of this one and this one, but this one sticks around. So that's kind of interesting. It's a very non-trivial thing in the standard model. So let's explore this. So the first point, which was said, is like, what do these have in terms of symmetry properties? So the easiest way to think about the CP violation is to basically you can take QED, and in QED you can relate F mu nu to both an electric field and a magnetic field. So in that case, you can just see that it's the easiest way to see that their CP is violated. So F mu nu, if you do in you decompose this into electric and magnetic fields, this is actually a dot product. And under CP, the electric field just goes to the electric field, but under CP, the magnetic field goes to minus the magnetic field. Okay? That's the way it's defined. So this flip sign, so this is a CP violating operator form in general. Okay, it's true for these. So the CP violation. Okay, but that's not enough because we have CP violating stuff in the standard model. Maybe I should make a slight divergence. That's really not the reason you would want to dismiss them, because, just as a side note, I'm not going to get into this in detail, we need more CP violation. So far, CP violation just lived in CKM in a phase, and there's something you can, where I'm not going to have time to go into this. Something called Sakharov conditions, which is that you want to have the observed matter be in the universe be different than the antimatter. So at some point you need CP violation, you need out of equilibrium conditions, and the CP violation in the standard model is not sufficient to generate the observed matter antimatter asymmetry experimentally in terms of cosmology. So we really, you know, we don't want to dismiss things that give us more CP violation because we need it. So that's not a good reason to get rid of it. But this doesn't do the job in this case, the standard model of solving that problem. But let's see what we can do to get rid of some of these. Okay. So the other point that was made, which is correct, is that you can define, that you can understand that this is a surface term. So take f mu nu, general form here, f mu nu tilde, and you can re-express it in terms of the gauge field building up this field strength in the following way. So this is 2 epsilon mu nu alpha beta a nu d alpha a beta. Okay. So this is something you can call you can just call this we'll just call it the symbol k mu. So this is a total derivative acting on something we built up out of the gauge fields, just integrating this by parts essentially. Right? So it's a four divergence. So it's a total derivative acting on something. So it's basically a surface term. Okay. So if we integrate over all space-time, then usually what we can do is neglect surface terms. You know, when we do field theory, frequently we do things like integrate by parts. And if you look closely at a lot of the derivations, you'll see statements of integration by parts. Up to a surface term, we change the form of the operator, we move a derivative from one field to another field, and we neglect surface terms. And then the argument goes through. Neglecting surface terms is, in trivial field configurations, that's related to total momentum conservation. Okay, so generally, if you have trivial field configurations at infinity, then total momentum conservation is allowing you to neglect these surface terms. Okay. Now, so it's going to matter, I said this statement, which was a key statement, trivial field configurations at infinity, right? So it's going to matter for the different field strengths which ones can have trivial field configurations at infinity and which ones don't have trivial field configurations at infinity. Remember, these are fields in space-time, and you can think of them as, you know, the quanta, the excitations of them. You could think of them having like non-trivial structure, like vortices or that sort of thing, in terms of the fields that were the background fields that we're expanding perturbation theory around. So there could be non-trivial topological structure at infinity for these fields. Okay? But in the case of b mu nu, because it's abelian, then we just use the surface term argument to get rid of that particular term. There's no argument that leads to the field configurations at infinity are non-trivial so that you have to keep this one around. So that's the reason that we get rid of this one in terms of what we think about. But then we have to think more carefully about the non-abelian field strength dual operators. This is called a dual field strength, by the way. This is a dual. Okay, so b mu nu, we've removed by surface term and trivial field configurations at infinity for such surface terms. But what about the others? What about this one? And then this one. Okay. So let's take on the electroweak one. And very interestingly, you'll see it's also related to this baryon minus lepton number, which is part of the reason I was emphasizing the global symmetry points of the standard model. Okay, so think about, once again, the global symmetries. a baryon and lepton number. So we'll do this e to the I baryon phase transformation. And for all the leptons. Okay, so then you can build symmetry currents. We put a third here, again, because of the color sum. With all the quarks and all the leptons. Okay, so we can just define these symmetry currents, these global symmetry currents, for these U1 phase transformations, these global transformations. And then, and I'm not going to do these diagrams in detail because I think it will generate more confusion than reduce confusion. But I will hopefully explain to you why these diagrams have an interesting, weird feature. Okay, so you can think about those symmetry currents. If those symmetry currents were conserved, then you would want equal to zero, and you would want equal to zero, right? If they were just conserved, and classically they are. But you can start to think about this current and putting this current in diagrams. Diagrams that have external gauge fields. And you're thinking about diagrams with external gauge fields because you're worried about, essentially, once again, the field configurations at infinity. Okay? So those are what are called anomaly diagrams. So they have this form. We insert the symmetry current here, either baryon or lepton number. And we just make a triangle.
Mike?
Yep.
Could you explain again why we need anomaly diagrams specifically to prove the...
Well, so it's not enough to just... So you can just check this at tree level, classically, it's zero. But it's not enough for it to be classically equal to zero. You know, you want to worry about quantum mechanical corrections. When you think about the matrix element of something, there's always a perturbative expansion. So at tree level, yeah, it's equal to zero, but that's not enough for there to be a real symmetry in the theory. Because you saw, I was trying to make this clear by how I frame this discussion. So you saw, okay, so you saw how there was this non-trivial structure to global lepton and baryon number preservation, okay? But this was really something following from the mass dimension of the operators and hypercharge. Okay, so it's in a sense an accident. It's not a gauge symmetry. These are global symmetries. They're not gauged, right? So they, you know, because we can see how they come about from hypercharge and the low mass dimension operator forms, and as soon as you start to write down higher mass dimension operators, like you go to like the next step, and immediately you find something that violates lepton number while still preserving hypercharge. So that should make clear, and I was trying to make this clear to you conceptually, that there's kind of like combined accidents happening in the standard model, okay? And those combined accidents lead to this global symmetry behavior for just the low mass dimension standard model operator forms. So because when, as soon as you start to write down this, you know, one of those accidents fails, you still have hypercharge conservation, but now you no longer have the same global symmetry structure. Conceptually, you should stand back and say, okay, wait, what is leading to this tree-level conservation of lepton and baryon number? Is it just an accident of the operator mass dimensions? And if that's the case, will it still be something that's preserved even in loop diagrams? Right? Because we just talked about how we could also write down operator forms like this, which we were not thinking about. But, you know, loops could generate these sorts of things. They do. And then you have to worry about what that actually means in terms of the symmetry preservation of the theory, the symmetry behavior of the theory beyond tree level. Because the reason you worry about that so much conceptually is that you know that you can take an operator form, particular operator form, and do loop contributions and get a different operator form, right? That happens all the time, right? So you have some operator like this. Sorry, I'm giving you the conceptual sort of thing. You have an operator like this, but then you take this operator twice, right? And then you have an operator like this. Right, so if there's a global symmetry that's being preserved just because of the operator forms, and if you know that once you start to do loop diagrams, you combine up operator forms, you get different operator forms, you should worry about also what happens under quantum corrections for these global symmetries. Okay? Hopefully that's conceptually clear. Okay. So that's okay. So we stick this symmetry current here, and we take gauge fields out to infinity. Okay? Now there's actually two of these. So you'd basically take this diagram. And you do the cross diagram with this one inserted. Just momentum flow means you have to, you know, if these are two external gauge fields, you have to basically tie this gauge field up to, you know, one polarization vector, and you need to do both of those to actually talk about the one loop contributions. Now, these diagrams, the external states are gauge fields. Okay, so again, going on the conceptual explanation path, the external states are gauge fields. And so you might worry that when you take those gauge fields to infinity, if you had non-trivial boundary conditions for the gauge fields, that could show up and lead to, when you actually execute the calculation of these diagrams in the math, something that was subtle that you would need to sort out. That actually does show up. What actually shows up in this math is that there's actually, well, so the sensitivity to the asymptotic that shows up as a momentum routing ambiguity, which is, I know, a really weird thing, but it actually is the case. So it's essentially how you choose to route the momentum that you're doing the D4 integration over, you'll actually see that there's a routing ambiguity that's present. And how you choose different ways to do the routing of the momentum, you get different results, it seems, naively. What that is really telling you is that you're sensitive to the differences in that momentum routing. You've introduced a sensitivity to something which usually you don't have a sensitivity to, which is the boundary condition of the gauge fields themselves. So this momentum routing ambiguity is associated with when you're doing these momentum integrals and you're looking at taking the limiting conditions for the external gauge fields in terms of their surface terms. Okay, so I know that's conceptually, I mean, I don't think it will help us here. So I'm suppressing that. I'm just trying to give you the conceptual framework of what's happening. So that momentum routing ambiguity, it actually shows up in both the baryon current and the lepton current. Okay? It's the same thing. So interior here, for gauge fields, we have a common gauge coupling. So if there's leptons in here, or quarks in here, for the baryon current or the lepton current, we still have the same gauge coupling. The contributions are actually the same. You get the same mathematical ambiguity in terms of writing the momentum, which corresponds to the surface boundary conditions of the gauge fields. In both cases, the gauge couplings are the same, and it comes with both the baryon and the lepton current. So if you have two currents which have an ambiguity at one loop, then obviously you can do combinations of them and cancel the ambiguity in one case if it's the same ambiguity. And that's all people do. So essentially, the observation is made is that even though at one loop, this is non-zero alone, if you form this, which is the baryon minus lepton number, it's still equal to zero at one loop. Whereas this is not equal to zero. And it's actually equal to there's also terms involving B for the external B field, but gives you an idea. Okay, so these individually have the ambiguity. They cancel when you take the subtraction. But the sum still has this. So what this says, remember we just talked about how baryon minus lepton number is equal to zero. And that's for true for even mass dimension operators classically at tree level. And that followed just from hypercharge. At one loop, it's again baryon minus lepton number for the currents. That's actually equal to zero. Okay? So it's kind of interesting that that shows up again. And it's non-trivial. That's the case. Okay. So damn it. There's no way for me to go and get into the QCD discussion in any coherent way. Okay. So baryon number minus lepton number is preserved even with loop corrections. But baryon number alone is not. Okay? So you would worry about baryon number violating effects. Okay, so we're going to have to postpone the last discussion mostly till next time, because I think it's just going to, okay. So let me just state it as a fact, and then you'll come back and you'll see as we develop further discussion on the QCD field strength, why this fact makes a lot of sense. But let me just declare it to you as a fact right now. So if you worry about baryon number violation alone, not baryon minus lepton number, but baryon number violation alone for proton decay, then you would still worry about effects in the field theory that lead to proton decay that are not necessarily easy to see classically or even at one loop, okay? There are such effects in a way that you'll see. This is a tilde. Very importantly, it's a tilde. These operator forms, in a way that we'll develop next time in detail, well, we talked about how they're related to boundary conditions at infinity. They're actually sensitive to topological configurations in the field at infinity. And so there can be different topological field configurations for the states that we're expanding around, vacuum we're expanding around. So you can imagine there being different field configurations. And then you can imagine that if you want to think about these things, transitioning between one and another, you have to change the topology of the asymptotic field configurations. That doesn't happen at any order in perturbation theory. But that can happen in quantum mechanics unless it's forbidden. That's actually a quantum tunneling effect. And Tuft showed that that quantum tunneling basically leads to a baryon number violation in the standard model at low temperatures. -160, which is very consistent with, it's not a problem for the lifetime of the proton. So at low temperatures. Okay, so which was 10 to the 33 years. So we are going to get into this in detail in the final discussion. You can think of these operators as having to do with measuring the asymptotic field configurations of the theory. They're non-zero. Unlike the case of b mu nu, they're non-zero because of like non-trivial field configurations you can have in non-abelian field strengths. You can have different non-trivial asymptotic boundary conditions, and transitioning between them, because there's a topology effect, doesn't happen in perturbation theory, but you can have effects that are not constructible in perturbation theory. If you take this and you expand it out in small g squared, you don't reconstruct this by doing perturbative loop diagrams. But such transitions can happen in the theory. There's something called instanton effects. And they're just basically quantum tunneling effects from one vacuum asymptotic field configuration to another asymptotic field configuration. And I know this is kind of just conceptual at this stage, but it will become clear when we go through in detail the axial anomaly in QCD. So those transitions do happen. They're very, very suppressed in the case of the standard model, but nevertheless, these effects do happen. So the baryon, so protons do decay in the standard model. They just decay consistent with experiment with lifetimes far in excess of the age of the universe. Okay, and it's related to this effect. I'm going to stop because the next thing we're going to do, the last thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about this sort of reasoning for the last field strength. This one. G mu nu. Okay? That one is even more interesting because what you're going to see is this you can't actually neglect because of there's not a baryon and lepton number around. Okay, so it's not leptons as well as baryons around, or quarks as well as leptons. So we can't build the difference in the currents. So when it comes to quarks, we're just stuck with the quarks themselves. So the anomaly we have to think about a little more carefully. And what happens in the case of these anomalies, in the case of QCD, spoiler alert, is that when you do those diagrams, you generate this operator and you can't get rid of it. So we've actually been neglecting this the whole way through, but the standard model needs to have, and we'll introduce this theta, needs to have this term. It violates CP. And this argument will flesh out for QCD in detail for the axial anomaly. And we'll prove that this is actually something that you can't remove from the theory. Okay? And more importantly, these sorts of effects, you might think at this stage this sounds like some weird kind of math and it doesn't lead to any measurable effects. But this physics actually does lead to measurable effects. So most famously, looking at these sorts of diagrams in QCD and thinking about this sort of thing in QCD leads to the decay of the pion into two photons to something called the West-Zimino-Witten term when you take chiral perturbation theory and you add that term to it. So I don't know if we'll get into this in detail, but we will basically develop in detail why this term of these cannot be neglected, and it is something that should be there. And then the question is, experimentally, what is this coefficient? Right? You might think it should be order 1 or 16 pi squared suppressed, but that's still not too small. It leads to CP violation. We can actually measure it. It's insanely small. So even though we can rather rigorously show that this term should not be neglected, and that sort of physics and that sort of thinking to do with asymptotic field configurations and introducing those sorts of effects in chiral perturbation theory lead to pion decay, When it comes to the experimental constraints on this, it's incredibly small. And no one really knows why. And that's the strong CP problem. And faculty members here are world experts on that sort of thing, because the strong CP problem, well, at least that's going to be for their class. They'll discuss it in more detail. But having some reason why this is as small as it is experimentally is something you model build for, and you try to basically resolve this issue. Yeah.
Why don't I get a similar problem for the W?
Sorry?
Why don't I get a similar problem for the W? Because
Sorry, say again.
Why don't I get a similar problem for the W?
In the case of the standard model, the difference of baryon minus lepton number is why you can, you know, basically not worry about. You basically can use a baryon minus lepton number conservation in the case of the standard model to not worry about these terms. It's B minus L global symmetry transformations allows you to rotate to set those to zero because of this. You do not have an equivalent transformation in the case of G mu, G mu. There is something which is very similar in the case of G mu, G mu dual. That would be the chiral the chiral transformations you can make on the fields and the massless quark limit. So similarly, because you have a symmetry transformation around B minus L symmetry transformations you can use to get rid of this term in the case of the standard model. In the massless quark limit, similar symmetry transformations, we'll flesh this out next time, symmetry transformations can be used so that you would be able to neglect this term and set this to zero. But the quarks are not massless, so that chiral, you know, the chiral perturbation, those symmetry transformations are not actually around, and you don't have that ability to redefine one vacuum into another just by a symmetry transformation. So essentially, you can get rid of it in the case of the standard model because you can do B minus L symmetry transformations, which can allow you to set it to zero. But that fails in the massive quark case for G mu, G mu. So we'll get into that next time. But that's the essential difference. So there's three of them. B mu, it's just trivial field configurations at infinity, essentially. W mu, there's the B minus L global symmetry, which allows you to continuously take this to zero, essentially by symmetry transformations. There would be the same argument here if the quarks were massless, but it's not. Because they're not massless, and we experimentally know they're not massless, we only need one even to be massless. So for a while, when it was observed experimentally that this was small, but you know, smaller than people expected, there was an open solution to this problem, which is like, well, maybe one of the quarks is massless. And if one of the quarks is massless, you have one chiral symmetry transformation that you can use, which you would then use it to set to zero, similar to the B mu, the W mu, W mu case. So that was called the U1 solution, or sorry, the up quark solution to the strong CP problem. At this stage, it's taken decades. That was like first proposed early 80s. It wasn't clear. It could have been, maybe. But as time has gone on, it's become clear, fitting the data, that you know, it's just not consistent with the data, you know, fitting the spectrum of states that we see in the mass perturbations we see in the spectrum to have the up quark mass be zero. It's experimentally, you know, statistically significant now. We need to fit it with a non-zero up quark mass. So that possible solution has gone away. So it needs to be something to basically make this make sense. So we'll just talk a little bit, well, we'll talk the whole time about this, essentially, next time, just try and flesh this out to make it clear. And that'll be where we end. The last problem. But that's it. Everything else works fine.